Hello, it's Anna Perrow and Sophie Little here. We run Soundyard and we are the producers of Chris Skinner's Countryside podcast.
We're excited to tell you we've been nominated for an award. It's a public vote, so if you'd like to vote for us, well, that would just be amazing. You can head to norfolkartsawards.org.
Look out for Soundyard. We're under the Broadcast and Media Award, and it's such a pleasure putting the show together and listening with you.
So let's join Chris and Matthew on High Ash Farm.
Chris Skinner's Countryside Podcast.
It's a grey October day on High Ash Farm at Caister St Edmund in the county of Norfolk. And, the skies look like they could provide rain, but it's still feeling very mild as well. And I've come to see farmer Chris Skinner for the latest instalment of the Countryside podcast. And we're under this wonderful oak here, aren't we, Chris?
Yes. Matthew, welcome to the farm. And welcome everybody who listens in as well. So we've got a windy day and we're very pleased we had 15 millimetres of rain last night. But before we go out on the farm, we've got a few things to look at, going back in history, of course. And there's a link here with the history, and it's just about to change. So we're just outside one of the old stable blocks. And if you'd like to come in.
In we go,
nice,
out
nice
of the wind.
Nice and warm in here.
Oh, yes.
And very, very special moment, because we've reared over 100 young swallows here at the farm this year, and they have virtually all but one gone. And I think there's just the one right at the end here. It's just out of the nest. The parents have gone for a third brood, would you believe? And it's a really risky thing to do, because if the weather changes and it's particularly cold, there'll be no flying insects, and this one will have to bite the dust.
Oh, on the fluorescent tube.
On the fluorescent tube, there's one youngster. I think there's three in the nest, and the others have been taken out by the parents, and they might bring them back in. And you can tell it's a youngster because there's no long tail streamers. So this little fella, if it's lucky, has got to fly down to South Africa starting in the next day or two.
Oh, and the wind's in the opposite direction.
At the moment it is, it would be flying into a headwind because it's a southerly or a southwesterly wind this morning.
It's quite late though, isn't it? We're in midway through October almost exactly.
Yes, we are. And it is late, but the season has been superb here for the swallows. On some of the old buildings which had corrugated roofs, I've put a double roof on them, and that sort of keeps it cooler inside the building. This is one of these old Norfolk pantile buildings, and it's insulated. There was wattle and daub under the tiles, and I re-roofed it, and it's really well insulated in there. The coldest night you can come in here, there's four horses in there. It's lovely and cozy, and on the hottest day in June, July time, you can come in, and it's remarkably cool. The walls are over a foot thick, and there's lots of old oak beams.
And swallows love being with the horses, don't they?
Absolutely. There's a relationship here, because I love a field full of cattle, red poles or Herefords. I'm as happy as pie. I nearly said something else. I'm as happy as anything with those, and I know how they think, I know what they need. Horses are a different kind of kettle of fish altogether, and very exacting. But nevertheless, the pastures have been allowed to stay at the farm, all around the farm premises. There's about 50 acres of permanent grass. The horses poo on the grass, and you have lots of flying insects, and that's the relationship, because swallows, swifts, house martins and sand martins, all four of those species, only take flying insects. They don't perch up, but this is an amazing sight. I think another one's just arrived. I was looking down. Maybe if we come in here, we might be lucky and see both of them.
Oh, two, yes.
There they are.
Two youngsters.
Yes, there's one probably flying out with mum and dad. They're taken for flying lessons before they all head off south. So fingers crossed for those two. They can make it down, so perhaps once they get to southern France, the weather down there will be more clement. That'll take them a few days. They kind of do 100-mile hops in a day. And so it's a 30-40 day journey to get down to South Africa, right down in Johannesburg region.
But they need a bit of luck.
They need luck because they haven't built their flight muscles particularly up yet. They've hardly been out of this barn. So with cool weather forecast for this coming weekend, the odd frost as well, that will stop the flying insects. So I always have trepidation that they won't make it, but it's always worth that gamble that a parents take it. If the worst happens, the parents will leave and sadly the young will starve to death, but it was still for the species, it's still worth going for that third brood.
And if all goes well, they'll come back in future years. They're imprinted on this place, aren't
absolutely
they?
And imprinted on me as well. My birthday's in September, but I know I've lived another year. First week of April, the first swallow arrives back, and that's something really special.
Bon voyage.
Bon voyage indeed. Good luck, you two.
Well, Chris has brought us for a short drive in the farm pickup to one of the far corners of the farm from the farmyard, and we're a bit out of the wind here, Chris, but it's still dry.
Yes, it's lovely. It's very, very mild this morning so far. I think we've got a taste of winter just round the corner, Matthew. That wouldn't surprise me.
So is your weather lore and your experience telling you that we might have a cold winter?
I've no idea, and lots of people have different sort of rules that they can decipher whether you're going to have a hard winter or not. And the first one would be if there's a good berry crop. And of course, out on the farm, this hedge has just been cut, but all over the farm, it is one of the heaviest crops of brambles, hawthorn, hips and sloes, the fruit of the blackthorn, that I've seen in years. And if you went by that, then you would be in for a stonkingly bad winter. It would be unbearable. And so it's a bit like the rule in the spring. The old farm workers would say, if the moorhens nest close to the water, it'd be a dry summer. And if they're nesting halfway up a tree, which they do sometimes, that pond will probably reach where they're nesting. And of course, it doesn't work like that. And anyway, we've come to what was the open field system here at the farm. And this area has been left uncut for 3 years. And you can see it's basically brown, it's overgrown. And I'm going to take us back into a part of the history which we visited last week, but I left out this portion on purpose. And something happened in 1773 that had a huge influence on what you can see out in the countryside all over the UK today. And it was something called the Enclosures Act. And it was brought in the reign of George III, as I said, 1773. And it enclosed open land. And if you remember, we discovered that a lot of the land was just open. Common land and agricultural land, there weren't boundaries. The peasants at that time set out their land in furlongs, and there wasn't any divisions. And the government didn't think that was right. They wanted to measure what land there was, and an accurate way of doing that was to decide without consultation to enclose 6.2 million acres of agricultural land and common land, in other words open land, across the UK. And that's what they did.
So the peasants were turfed off?
They, in a way they were, yes, but something strange happened. So enclosures meant you had to either dig a ditch around your field or plant a hedge. And why it's appropriate today is because it settles a lot of legal arguments. So beside us is a hedge, Matthew, and the other side is a ditch with water running down it. Now, when you did the enclosure, if it was in the middle of your farm, it didn't really matter which side the hedge went. But generally, when you dug the ditch, you threw the soil, if it was close to a neighbour's property, onto your own land. Then on top of that mound that you dug out to make the ditch, you planted a hedge. And as we were a seafaring nation, when you look down this row, there's a beautiful avenue of oak trees. And so oaks were planted in amongst the hedge as well. And there's 1,500 individual oaks here at High Ash Farm. So it had a huge impact. And many of those hedges have survived. The old open field system absolutely ceased at that time. And farmers, well, the only way to describe it was incandescent. If you see a farmer with a red face, he's probably inherited it from 1773 because they didn't feel the government had any right to do this at all. So it caused a huge amount of friction. But after about 4 years, when farmers are having a good time, they go very quiet. And the reason they went quiet is because the cattle and the crops were all in enclosures, and something magical happened. If we just walk through to the gateway here, I'll explain what we're seeing.
There's a little entrance here between the two hedges and
yes.
the ditches. Oh,
so
and there's a ditch going under.
There's a ditch with the water running down it. Now, behind us is what agricultural land and grassland would have looked like, overgrown. And because the cattle could kind of wander anywhere on big open spaces.
Pre-1770s.
Yes, exactly that. Now, what then happened, we have this field, it's enclosed by the hedge. I'll just stand there to keep the wind off the microphone. It's blowing a hoolie now. And you can see the field has been cut for hay and it's being grazed by sheep now. Now, can you see the difference between that field, which is fenced and grazed, and the one behind us? So something magical happened. A particular word is called perpetual spring. So what that means is, if the cattle grazed down the grass, it kept growing. It couldn't go to seed and it couldn't then die, which would be the normal cycle in grassland. Now, it's a bit like your lawn. If you mow your lawn regularly, don't laugh like that. If you mow your lawn regularly, it'll stay green more or less through the end. Unless you have really, really dry weather, it'll go brown, but then it will recover. And that's what's happened here. So all the nutrition stays in the grass because the grass doesn't have the chance to produce its seed head and produce the seed, and the seed would then drop on the ground and the cycle would start all over again.
So you get lovely grazing land, and
exactly.
That means more productivity.
Oh, exactly. You hit the nail on the head there. So the first thing that happened is milk yields went up. Some of the land was used for sheep, as this is today on the farm here. Some was used for fattening cattle. So they all started to thrive. And then if the ground was allowed to stay as grassland for 2 or 3 years, it was then ploughed up. And the fertility had built up hugely because of the grass roots, and is easy to plough. And so you also had record grain yields, and that is why the farmers all went quiet. They'd been completely, completely wrong. The politicians were ignorant about what was going to happen because they had no idea either. And so this magical trick of perpetual spring happened, and that's why this field is lovely and green. If I hadn't mowed it for hay and the sheep weren't on there, it would be an overgrown, brown, tangled mess with very little nutrition. So it's the nutrition that's kept in the grass. The sun photosynthesizes into the chlorophyll in the grass, and it tries to keep growing, but it can't complete its life cycle because we're harvesting its energy.
So that's for farming, but over here, that is for wildlife.
Exactly that. Now, yes, so it's left unmown, and that's what I've tried to do. So it's a wonder I don't sort of fall in half, because half of me is a farmer and the other half is trying to do what modern farmers are trying to do, being just a conservationist, I suppose. And it is difficult to marry the two when you're brought up to look after the land and become a steward of it. Then it is a hard trick to follow, but I've learnt so much. So that Agricultural Act in 1773, the Enclosures Act, settles huge legal arguments today, because if you buy a piece of land and there's a ditch the other side of it and a hedge your side, the rule is, and always has been, hedge takes ditch. And it's been through the courts hundreds of times, and that rule has hardly ever been broken. hedge takes ditch. So when you buy your estate, Matthew, you'll know exactly where your boundary is.
I'm looking forward to that day. And in the meantime, the ditch is looking marvellous with actually water.
Water running flowing down it. And once it gets to the chalk layer further in the other corner of the field, that's it. It disappears into the chalk aquifer. Listen to that.
Through one of the farm gates and into a field where horses often are found, and there's some over there. This is a nice place for them to graze and enjoy some of the shade in the summer.
Yes, it's beautiful. It's called Burnt House Meadow because in the far corner of the meadow, well, it would interest you, Matthew, you can see some flat ground there. This was the village cricket pitch.
Well, how long ago was that?
Early 1900s until about the 1930s. And one of the farm workers here told me he was a young lad playing cricket and he hit a six and he broke a window in Queen Anne Cottage on the other side of the road. Went right over Caister Lane.
The latter-day Ben Stokes.
Yes.
For our American listeners, well, you know, a horse behind us. No need to worry too much about cricket, but suffice it to say that back 100 years ago, every village in Norfolk would have had a meadow where they played cricket.
Yes, there's a little hamlet right next door, and the cricket pitch there became quite famous. It was Dunstan, right next to Dunstan Hall, and I played on there a few times, but I was pretty useless. I was very good at throwing, but bowling was another game altogether. So there we are. So, right, we've just come up to the end of the field, and there's some woodland here. Mainly ash trees. Most of them are okay. The one above us has got ash dieback, actually. You can see bare branches and it's meant to be in full leaf at the moment. And a little bit of history here, because there's an understory of shrubs in the bottom of the wood. They're only about 6 to 8 feet high and they've been here since the sort of mid 1800s. So although we've gone back into history, it's going to take us right forwards, because these are the result of a gentleman who was born in Wells. His father was a school teacher and his name was Robert Ransom, and he was very interested in farming and farm implements, and he sort of designed a plough, which many farmers will know was still available. It was manufactured by Ransoms and Sims and Jeffries in Ipswich right up until about the 1950s. It was a two-furrow reversible plough. But before that, Robert Ransom made sort of what we call one-way ploughs, where the plough would just turn the soil to the right, and then you'd come back down the field and you'd have a furrow left in the field when you'd done areas of the field. They were called lands in between the furrows. And right beside me, I had to bring this. It's a picture of three horses and it's a field right next door, a team of three.
That's an old black and white photo.
This is a Ransom's two-furrow one-way plough behind it, and at the back of the three horses, they're Suffolks, big, heavy working horses, all shackled up. This is my father, at the age of 15 years old.
Your dad there.
And if I look on the back, 9th January 1925, Samuel Skinner ploughing at the camp, the Roman town, age 16, with a Ransom's two-furrow plough.
99 years ago, almost exactly.
Yes, exactly that. Now, Robert Ransom was very good. He won an award for this plough, and he won £250. £200 went to set up the Ransom, Sims and Jeffries plant in Ipswich, close to the River Orwell, and they made these ploughs there, and eventually they developed into what we now call a reversible plough, which is two furrows on top, two furrows underneath, rather like this one-way plough. But when you got to the end of the field, you lifted the plough up, you pulled the lever by hand with the early reversible ploughs. Mine was a TS82, two-furrow plough. I pulled it behind a Fordson Major, no cab on the tractor. My hands would get so cold, I couldn't let go of the steering wheel. I had to peel my fingers off.
Yeah. So no heating and stereo?
Absolutely nothing like that at all. And it's so recent, it's in my lifetime. And this is a surprise, that how quickly agricultural production changed. It went through a really difficult period between the world wars. In fact, we had the agricultural depression between 1918 and 1940, roughly. And so at that point, the whole farm, this estate, came up for sale, and prices were so depressed. So 640 acres came up for sale. Caister Hall, next to us, just through the trees there, 14 tied cottages with the farm, High Ash Farmhouse, where I was born, and it was withdrawn at 12,000 guineas. You can't get your front drives shingled for that today. Just amazing. And so it went through a huge depression. And at the end of that, we had the Second World War. Home food production suddenly became a priority, and the government did another one of these huge acts which didn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people. 1947, at the end of the Second World War, they brought out the Agricultural Holdings Act. And what that said was, if you're a tenant farmer, we would like you to be committed to your farm, and we will make you almost like a landlord for your generation, for your son's generation, and your grandson's generation. So it became known as a three-generation tenancy. And it's still here today. And many farmers, although they're in their 60s and 70s, it will pass on perhaps one more generation after that. And that will probably happen here. But as I said, if I go back a bit, Robert Ransom was a really clever marketer. And if we walk forwards, the result of his marketing is in this corner of the farm, because with his ploughs, he sold cast iron points, and they were held on by little wooden dowels, rather like raw plugs, and the points had a hole in them. And with each plough that he sold, you were given four or six of these plants in front of us. They're called snowberries. They're also called lardy balls, because
there are white berries here.
There are pure white berries on them, and they stay on over the winter. The reason they're called lardy balls is lard used to be stored in pig's bladders, and it was twisted up rather like sausages, much, much smaller. And so these are meant to look like lardy balls.
Well, it's my the same colour, isn't it?
And it's the same colour as lard, pure white. There's a few seeds in them, and children love dropping them on the ground, and if you stand on them, you generally get a big pop when they're a little bit wider. That one just squidged. Now, when you look at the wood on this snowberry plant, it is the right diameter, and it is rock hard. It's exactly like a raw plug, Matthew. I'll try and snap one. Let's see. I can't hardly break it. It's that hard. And you dry these, and this is what you use to keep the points on your plough, so you could grow your own raw plugs, if you like, to hold them on, these cast iron points, which Robert Ransom also designed, manufactured at Ipswich. He employed one man in the factory to start with. His plough award won him £250, and he set the whole factory up for £200. Talk about an entrepreneur. And of course, he came from Norfolk. His dad was in Wells in North Norfolk, and I have a huge respect. And so I keep this little patch down here to remind me of what my father used here on his Ransom's plough, and what Robert Ransom designed. So there we are, snowberry stays on. It's an interesting plant. It's introduced from North America in about the 1700s, so it's been here quite a while. It's got very inconspicuous flowers. It will flower at this time of the year as well, but this is the time of year when the leaves now come off and you're left with this huge array of snow-white berries, about marble size.
And all these plants came with the plough.
With the plough, and you planted them out, and gamekeepers got the hang of it because it provides a lovely understory in the woods. So they started planting snowberry out as game cover as well. But the original person to do it was Robert Ransom, way back then. Such a clever man. Of course, he came from Norfolk.
Of course. Well, I mean, we talk about the cost of being in pounds. And if you're wondering, maybe some of our overseas listeners are wondering about guineas.
Yes.
Well, they were the equivalent nowadays of £1.05.
£1 and a shilling, as it was back then, yes.
And I think the 5 pence or the shilling was like the commission for an agent.
Probably, as you would know, yes, either the agent's commission or... I think horses are still sold in guineas at Newmarket today in the next county. So a very posh way of selling it. And, of course, you'd probably pay for it in sovereigns. So there we are.
Who's this? I don't think this horse will win any races at Newmarket.
No, I don't think this one will. But it's got feathers on its feet. It's not a bird. This is a kind of old working horse. Hello, you. Look at this.
He's a beauty, isn't he?
He's a beauty, yes. Only about 14 hands, so not big. Been out in the rain overnight, but very hardy. I think that one's a native breed. So there we are, a little bit of history, and I just love the fact that Robert Ransom designed his ploughs, won an award, and became one of the most famous and the largest employer down in Ipswich. And he had his own colour that he painted his ploughs with, named after the river that comes out there. It's called Orwell Blue. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to High Ash Farm. It's a wet evening after a long day's work here at the farm. And I've just driven down one of the farm tracks and I'm going to drive in to the edge of a piece of woodland because I hope to see something quite special. It's raining hard, but that means it's a perfect evening because the rain has removed all the scents out on the field. I walked across here earlier. It's a very ancient field. It's called Brokenback. And I'm just driving into the wood. Hopefully the car will get there. Yes, in we go. In amongst the trees. And I'm just going to drive about halfway along one of the old shooting rides here at the farm. Because halfway along the wood there's a big gap through the trees where an ancient oak tree fell over onto the field and it's left a lovely wide margin, and I'll explain why in a moment. We're nearly there, and then I can turn the windscreen wipers off just a bit further. Yes, nearly there. And perfect view coming up. There we are. Turn the windscreen wipers off. It's still raining quite hard. And there. Turn the engine off. Lights off. It's just you and me and my terrible terrier. He has decided to roll in the wettest, smelliest patch of fox poo that you can possibly imagine. And he's sitting on the passenger seat right beside me, and he thinks it's wonderful. I think he imagined he's sort of embalmed himself in the best perfume that nature can provide. All I can say, it's a pretty horrendous smell. He doesn't know what he's got coming late. He's going to have a bath. So that's the end of that one. Right. Now, I've been lent a very special pair of binoculars for this. And just going to get them out. They're beside me. Here we are. And rather unusual, they're not highly powered. They're about 8 magnifications, 8x, and there's a little switch, a button on the top of them, which I'll turn on in a few minutes. The sun's set, and it's already dusk. It's raining, so there's a cloud cover as well. And that means it's kind of extra dark, which is a really good help for tonight, what we're actually up to. Just as I drove in, it's a pair of monk jack deer, a mum and a tiny fawn, and they darted into the edge of the woodland that I've just driven into. Now, out of this gap that I'm looking through, I'm actually in the woodland, but I'm looking through the gap over a very deep valley. It's about, what, 80, 90 feet deep. And it stretches up. Halfway up the other side of the valley is a hedge going right across from left to right. And then the hill continues right to the crest. And beyond that is the town of Norwich. So there's a little bit of light coming from all the street lights. Now, this afternoon, I was hedging on the edge of this field in front of me. As I said, it's an ancient field. It's called Broken Back. Nobody quite knows how it got its name, or whether it was just back-breaking work for the horses to go all the way up this hill. It's a long-sided valley, perhaps 300-400 metres to get to the top of the hill on the other side of the valley. But it's the ideal habitat for some of the mammals here at the farm, and one particular mammal, which I came across this afternoon while I was hedging. First of all, I sort of got out of the tractor, walked out into the field a little bit to look at the crop, which is pollen and nectar, and it had regrown about 4 inches tall since we mowed it in the beginning of September. And I disturbed a leveret, and it scooched off to the left, running rather like a rabbit, but instead of going into the woodland where I'm sitting, it ran out into the open, and very small, probably only about a week, 10 days old, because it's been warm in Norfolk here at this time of the year, unseasonably warm, in fact, and a little bit of grass growth as well. The hares have decided to bring off another brood, which they can do at really any time of the year. Then I'd walked a little bit further, so that was a lovely sight, and another one, not far away from the first one, scooched off to the other side and did head towards a hedge, but it was definitely a leveret or a young hare. So, from my knowledge of hares, and I've lived with them most of my life, right from my childhood when they were shot here at the farm, they were regarded as pests. And before that, of course, they were one of the beasts of venery. And one of the, that meant it was one of the really good creatures to hunt for sport, for fun, and also made good eating as well. So, a lot of history attached to hares, brown hares, as we call them here, not mountain hares, which are almost like a different species. These have very long ears, lovely tawny gold coat, and white fur underneath, a second layer of fur, which helps insulate them. Hares are almost the opposite to rabbits. That sounds a funny thing to say. Firstly, they're much larger, at least double the size. When hares head for, they've got these really long hind legs, and they'll use the hills here at High Ash Farm to propel them up so that they can get away from predators. So young hares or leverets are born out in the open, any more or less any time of the year. Rabbits are born down in a burrow or a stop underneath the ground. Young rabbits are hairless when they're born. Young hares are covered in hair. Young hares are born with their eyes open. Young rabbits are born with their eyes closed. So distinct differences. Rabbits are generally will run to cover if they're disturbed. Hares run out in the open, making the use of those really long, powerful back legs. And from the moment of their birth, they spend their entire life more or less out in the open countryside. So with modern agriculture, they're quite vulnerable to agricultural practices. They're also, particularly in Norfolk at this time of the year, we have more and more buzzards, and buzzards sort of hunt, so do carrion crows. They'll hunt over grassland just looking for the leverets, and they seem to be trained by their mother, or it's instinctive in them, to stay still from the point of birth. Normally a gill or a doe hare will give birth to 3-4 young leverets in one spot, and then she'll cart them off to different places so that they're not, you don't kind of have all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. So they're distributed about roughly in a local area, and she will spend the day some distance away, but presumably kind of keeping an eye on them, although she won't do anything to protect them unless it's pretty obvious. That would be rather stupid if a dog was going to kill, or a fox or a carrion crow come in. It's unlikely that she'll interfere, and nature will sadly have to take its course. So now this is where the magic happens. I'm going to turn the special EV binoculars on, which are night vision binoculars. EVs just means enhanced visual. So these have been lent to me, and I'm just going to turn them on. A little bit difficult because I'm holding the microphone in one hand and the binoculars in the other, and I'm just scanning across the other side of the valley, and I can see lots of white specks over in the distance. Not sure what they are. That's too far away to see, so I'm going to come in a bit closer, about 250 metres away, and there doesn't seem to be much there at all. No, I can see something. It's another monk jack deer and another youngster, and they're right close to the line of hedge on the other side of the field. I've got the windows of the car shut, and I'm enjoying this rather lovely perfume from Rat. So what I'm going to do is to come back in a short while when we have a bit of activity, because what I hope to see, and it's a chance, a very small chance, is one of the doe or the gill hares coming to actually feed one of the young leverets that I saw, and that would be absolutely wonderful. So instead of me talking to myself and enjoying the lovely aroma of Rat sitting beside me, we're going to go quiet for a few minutes, and if we see something special, then I'll certainly turn the microphone back on and try and share any magic moments that we have with you. Welcome back, everybody. It's just about 9 o'clock in the evening, and it will soon be the middle of October, so I'm expecting some cold weather before long, but it's still hanging on just on the mild side of where it should be at this time of the year. And things have started to happen. I've managed to tape the microphone to the steering wheel of the truck, so that's left both hands free for these wonderful binoculars, and I've been experimenting with them in the last 30 minutes. And they're absolutely fantastic nighttime vision binoculars. And I've been watching a pair of young roe deer. I think parents or the adults are rutting at the moment, and the young from earlier this year have been cast away to fend for themselves now. And they're both grazing on the other side of the hedge, on the far side of the valley, up on the sainfoin and the clover, which is absolutely ideal for them. And this side of the hedge, been watching a pair of badgers. They might be this year's young as well, and they've been going steadily along the hedge. The hedge is coming up as dark, very dark, almost black on the binoculars, and the badgers you can see really, really clearly, and with their reflective eyes as well. And I'm just watching them going along, and they've just come up to an area where rabbits have been digging, and one of the badgers has just disappeared out of sight with the binoculars. The other one's still quite visible. I think it's gone down into the warren, just looking for an early supper, perhaps, or just seeing if there's any adult rabbits there to make a quick kill. They will take rabbits. They'll also take nesting birds' eggs, dig out wasps' nests, and anything along the edge of that hedgerow that they can see. But they're basically hugged to the hedge. So we've seen monkjack deer, young roe deer, and a pair of badgers. And on the far side of the hedge, right almost on the crest of the hill, I've been watching two or three hares, expecting them to come this way. In fact, I can see another one now. So there's four adult hares up there. And virtually all of them, apart from one, has moved in the opposite direction to where I am. They can't hear me because I've got the window shut on the truck. And the only giveaway clue is the enormous smell that's perhaps escaping from the truck here with my terrible terrier. And with the smell of fox poo, but I don't know if that's an advantage or a disadvantage. So I'm still waiting and watching. And one of the hares is just sort of, hanging about on the other side of the hedge. I'm watching very carefully, just scanning across the field a little bit closer. A couple of white blobs there, one with very clear eyes, and oh lovely, I can actually see the beak. It's a pair of woodcock. In fact, there's three of them about 50 yards from me, and because it's been raining, the rain's eased off a moment or two now. I think there's more dew later on tonight, so the ground is moist. The worms have come up to the top and they're actually just running along. They're kind of woodland waders, I suppose. The waders that have deserted salt marshes and marshes, and you'll often find them on agricultural land these days, and even in woodland, hence woodcock. So they're long legs, very, very long beak, beautiful brown camouflaged plumage, but you can see them really clearly, so they must be quite warm because they're shining up really brightly in these binoculars. Mind you, they're quite close to me compared to the hares, and they're just presumably just gleaning worms off the top of the surface, which will have come up because of the damp weather. It's been very dry in Norfolk up until this point, as we're coming up to the middle of October now. So that's a lovely sight. They're probably UK resident woodcock. I haven't seen any signs of them coming over from the continent. Once it gets really cold in Eastern Europe, they'll move across to Western Europe and then hop across the North Sea and invade our shores, because we've got a maritime influence to our climate here in the UK, and generally we don't have severe winters in the way that they do over in Europe. So very welcome here, particularly if they've been breeding here, particularly at High Ash Farm. Lots of suitable habitat for them. Binoculars back up. And that hare has disappeared, the one that I was watching. That's what happens. Take your eye off what you're talking about. And it's great. It's come through to this side of the hedge. It's on the far side of the valley, probably 150, 180 metres away from me. And it's just sitting there now. Now, where I saw the leverets is halfway between where the hare is now and where the leverets are. So the leverets that I saw, they're probably still there. So we're going to just wait a moment or two and see if she's going to come down. If it is a she, could be a jack hare, or the other name for them is a buck. And hares, you're hare-brained if you're a bit scatty, and I suppose hares are rather of that ilk, I suppose, and you'll often see them in the early airports, particularly down at Gatwick. Lots of people noticed them running alongside the aircraft as either they took off or landed, so it got the name of a hareport. So they have got this rather eccentric manner about them. And they also suffer another word that, if you like, that's come into our language is hare-lipped, because hares have a split lip which they call through. And rabbits also have a split lip, but it's covered with the teeth are covered with a membrane just under the lip, whereas hares, that membrane is absent. So they, from the top of the lip, almost where the nose is, right down to where the teeth are, the lip is split completely, and hence hare lip. So, and that's a really unfortunate condition that sometimes humans have, but it's remedied with modern surgery these days, so it's not too much of a handicap anymore than compared to what it used to be. And let's have a look, another look, see where this hare's gone. And it has gone. It's disappeared. I'm going to have to scan round. It's coming towards us. Perfect. Right, I'm going to keep my eyes on it this time through the binoculars. And it's come sort of, it's getting towards halfway down the other side of the valley hill, heading towards me. The dip of the valley's right at the bottom, and that's close to where the leverets were. And it's stopped. It's sitting up. Really clearly, beautiful sight now. I mean, this is amazing. If I take the binoculars away from my eyes, I can't see a thing. Put them back, and I've got a kind of perfect negative view. So instead of the hare being very dark, it's very light. And all the different parts of it are lit up depending on how much heat is coming away from the animal. So the eyes and around the mouth and nostrils, and the hare's sitting up, if it is a she, sitting up on her haunches. And I can now see one of the leverets about 20 yards away to her left, and it's moving towards her. She's just got her in the left-hand lens, and the leveret is moving across and coming up towards her. So whether she's mum or not, I don't know, but they're about 5 yards apart now. Oh, this is absolutely wonderful. I'm going to invite Matthew, who normally accompanies me on the visits, for a visit to High Ash Farm. We're going to do a nocturnal safari in the next week or two, on the one or two podcasts away, and we'll see what we can see as we go around together. I'd much rather that somebody was here actually watching this with me. It's an absolute magical moment. Instead, I'm sharing it with a very stinky dog. They're only about a yard apart now, and she's still sitting bolt upright. Now she's standing, and the leveret is coming up. I think, yep, it's gone under her. So she's actually suckling. Presumably it's her own leveret, but hares will nurse other leverets than their own. And that's quite a well-known fact. Or it can be a leveret from a previous litter from her. And another one has just come in from the other side, from the left. So she must, because it's a distance away, she must be calling them. Otherwise, I don't think they could know that she's there. So whether it's the hares do call through that split lip, I won't try and imitate it, although I've been taught how to do that. It's a really strange sound, as though you're sort of sucking air through the corner of your lip. This is an absolute magical moment. I've only seen this once before in my life. I've been told that it happens just after dusk, but it's just after 9 o'clock, so it's been fully dark for an hour and a half now. And all that I do know is that hares just suckle their young just once every 24 hours, and then the young are left wherever they choose under some grass, and they're kind of trained not to move. As I said, we've got buzzards, carrion crows, hunting these fields all day, every day. I don't think a red kite would probably take them, although red kites are generally carrion feeders. We've got those here at the farm as well. And, of course, foxes. Badgers won't say no to a young hare. Stoats, weasels. We've got all of those predators. So when you're born as a baby outside in all the weathers that the Norfolk countryside can throw at you, they're really fantastic mammals to share the farm with. So I'm pretty proud to have them here. But this is a wonderful sight. I wish this was a video camera and I could kind of zoom in as well. But that's asking a little bit much, considering it's jet black now. It's just a faint light. If I lift the binoculars up, it's a faint light on the horizon where the light's coming from the city street lights of Norwich. So there we are, a special treat for me, and I hope you've enjoyed that, and we'll invite Matthew out to share the delights of this farm in an evening coming up quite soon. So there we are, a hare standing on all four legs, quite high up on her legs, suckling now two leverets. What an amazing sight.
This is a Soundyard production. Music by Tom Harris.
Hello, Anna here from Soundyard with a little reminder that we've got our donations page available should you want to support the production of the Countryside podcast and our CD service for people without the internet. Just head over to donorbox.org/countrysidepodcast. That's donorbox.org/countrysidepodcast to make a donation. Or if you'd rather send a cheque, then just make it payable to Soundyard CIC and post it to Soundyard 132 Magdalen Street, Norwich, NR3 1JD. See you soon!